Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidel. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I am Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, let me, without delay, thank you, Audrey, one more time for getting us connected. A couple phone numbers to deal with here tonight, but we made it perfectly, as you always do. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and this is the Jumble Justice Radio Show. Johnny Cash took us on that trip again one night. Have we ever played, Mike, the entire song where Johnny Cash takes us around the globe? No. It's not around the globe, it's just around the United States. But anyway, it's a very interesting song, very difficult song to remember the lyrics to without looking at it. And I'm told that Johnny Cash, and I've read, that he sang that song from memory. And when you do a song a zillion times, as he probably did that one, I'm sure he could do it. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Audrey, thank you. Lucy's not here again tonight. She's still on vacation, so Mike's going to do our blonde joke for the evening. I thought that'd be a little bit of a switch. He's got an interesting one to talk about. We want to discuss news issues and events and developments in this difficult field of criminal justice. Sometimes it's humorous, sometimes it's not so humorous. We have some things going on now that aren't very humorous, and our show is dedicated to these energetic and never-tiring police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals. We probably don't thank enough, do we? They don't expect it. They really don't, but they protect us throughout the United States, and some of our agents, of course, protect us around the world. So what we try to do is look inside criminal justice and take a close-up look at the professionals at work. And sometimes it's not exactly that, and tonight would be one of those shows. We want to thank Alan Levy, who's the CEO of BTR, that started this thing who knows how many years ago, and now there are literally thousands of shows on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and right up at the top of the page when you go to BTR, Blog Talk Radio Network, you can start your radio show, I think, in a minute, maybe. You can start broadcasting and connect with friends all around the world. So it is possible that any person in the interest group, any organization, can have their own show. They can broadcast worldwide in streaming audio to an unlimited number of listeners, and that doesn't cost you one penny. Now you can upgrade and change the times and things like that, and it might cost you a little bit, but still it's not much. Just think 15 years ago what it would take to broadcast around the world, and it will help you appreciate what BTR has done for us. Tonight I'm going to give you a little preview of what we're going to do. We're going to have John Lott Jr. On the show, and John Lott is the data authority on concealed carry weapons in the gun debate in America. His book, More Guns, Less Crime, is now in its third edition, and he is presenting that in about a 54-minute video. We never get to see all of them, but I think you'll really enjoy John Lott. I brought John to my university here a number of years back when More Guns, Less Crime started, and we had people actually sitting in the hallways that came to listen to him. He was a Yale, or excuse me, University of Chicago professor at that time. He's been at Yale, University of Maryland, a number of other places, but a real scholar on that particular subject. Let me recommend a good book to you that I just got in the mail, I ordered and paid for. It's called Shooting Blanks, and it's a 2011 publication late, and it's by Alan Gottlieb and David Workman. The title is Shooting Blanks, and what this the subtitle is Facts Don't Matter to the Gun Control Ban. And each chapter takes a look at what's going on over the last 15 years or so about what the anti-gun people have said was going to happen, and these are virtually all myths. And the chapter headings, each chapter deals with one of those things. Chapter 1, there'll be blood in the streets. Chapter 2, banning guns makes society safer. Chapter 3, only police should have guns. Goes on and on. Gun safety laws save children, on and on. He dispels all the myths of these gentlemen do in both of these. It's Alan Gottlieb and David Workman. It's a real good read, and it's they're both really good writers. It's about 82 pages, and I think it's about $15 on Amazon.com, so I highly recommend that book. It is a late thing. I haven't seen if they quote me in there or not, but I got a book called With Liberty and Guns for All, Primer America's Firearms Debate. It's getting a little bit dated now, but anyway, I think you would really enjoy that book. If you want to call in tonight during the news segment, we're going to make it a little bit short because we want to hear as much of John Lott as we can, but the call-in number is 347-996-5983. And we could hold 100 callers at the same time. Mike, how about that blonde joke? Let's do a little blonde joke tonight. And I think you'll enjoy this one. Mike, can you find it? Oh, but you can. Try. You can find it? There it is. Okay. Let's see. Let's hear it.
Stupid blonde boss. That's the opposite, NASA. She states she wants to be the first person to fly to the sun. The executive director. This beautiful blonde walks into the executive director's office at NASA. She states she wants to be the first person to fly to the sun. The executive director laughs at her and says, "You don't understand. The sun is so hot that you would burn up before your ship got halfway there." She goes, "Duh, I was going to go at night."
Okay, thank you very much, Mike, for that one. I think we should also, very appropriate for tonight, we should play the warning message put out by the Ohio Gun Coalition Against Firearms. And they're trying to get this message out to all the criminals all over the streets of not only Ohio, but the nation.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Ohio Coalition, I just recommend that you don't talk to John Lott, or Alan Gottlieb, or David Workman, because they've got some data that may counter what you're thinking. Well, how about a green tip for tonight? Here's one for this evening. I think you'll enjoy. This one also comes from Esma Floyd's little book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And her book is little. It's a very nice book. And this one has to do with something very sensible. And I bet people nowadays still don't do this. I've been in drugstores and I see rows of greeting cards of one kind or another. It says, think about it, send an e-card. Send an e-card instead of buying cards and envelopes made from paper, then relying on the road or air transport for them to be delivered. It's cheaper, easier, and much better for the environment to send an e-card. Now, I don't know who's running the big calculator up in the sky, but there must be some energy use involved in e-cards, but you know, I don't know how to calculate that myself. Some electrical engineer might, or physicist or something, but I certainly don't. But that's a good tip that Esma Floyd provides for us. Let's take a little look, literally tonight, in the news and see what's going on. A couple of these things are a little bit weird and require quite a bit of explanation, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them, but we've been talking about off and on here the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms and explosives unit of the federal government and their fast and furious operation. Attorney General Holder and the head of ATFE has been before Congress several times now. This is the one where they had literally a couple thousand guns. They released it, illegal guns to people illegally in the Southwest, and then they were going to track these guns if they went into Mexico with the drug cartels and that type of thing, and then they'd be able to make arrests and, you know, do what they should do. Well, of course, they lost control virtually of all the guns. I think it was almost 2,000. And then we have the young Border Patrol agent that was killed, and two or three of those guns were found at the scene where he was murdered. His name was Brian Terry. He was shot to death in December of 2010. Well, guess what we just found out? This just came out. This is dated March 18, 2012, 7 months after the federal agents began the ill-fated Fast and Furious gun tracking operation. They stumbled upon their main suspect in a remote Arizona outpost on the Mexican border, driving an old BMW with 74 rounds of ammunition and 9 cell phones hidden inside. Detained for questioning that day, Manuel Fabian Solis Acosta described to agents from Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives his close association with a top Mexican drug cartel member, according to documents obtained this weekend by the Times Tribune Washington Bureau. The top Fast and Furious investigator, Special Agent Hope McAllister, she scribbled her phone number on a $10 bill after he pledged to cooperate and keep in touch with her. Then Solis Acosta disappeared into Mexico and he never called. Had he been arrested red-handed or trying to smuggle ammunition into Mexico, Fast and Furious might have ended quickly. Instead, the program dragged on for another 8 months, and it spiraled out of control. I just can't believe these kind of things happen. The guy promises he'll call and stay in touch and, you know, be an informant and that type of thing, and the woman agent, she takes his word, a man agent, the whole outfit agreed to this sort of thing, and he takes off into Mexico, has never been seen again. But isn't that sad that, and all this, you know, is in addition to the fact that, Agent Terry, the Border Patrol agent, was killed with some of these guns. Unbelievable. This one, I think, is another one that requires high IQ test. This is in Rockford, Illinois, and this is a very long story. It goes into detail, but a high school student claims in court that his school district and the sheriff conducted a boneheaded safety drill in which a fake intruder entered school with a realistic-looking cap gun, fired two shots, and singled him out as a target. And that, after the student fled, sheriff's officers interrogated him about selling drugs before revealing that it was all just pretend. Can you believe this? I mean, the sheriff in this area allowed a drill like that and the school superintendent to go on. Shaw Stevenson County Sheriff David Snyder, Sheriff's Officer Wendell McLean, the Orangeville Community School District, and a superintendent, they all were part of the Shaw claims that the defendants planned school safety drill to take place on May 6, 2011, at the Orangeville Junior Senior High School. Orangeville is a town of about 800 on the Wisconsin border. Shaw said the teachers were informed of the drill ahead of time, but the students were not. Can you imagine the kind of things that could have happened in a drill like that? Wendell McLean was scheduled for the role of the armed intruder, in part because he was African-American. Under the plan, the teachers of the school were to be informed in advance the drill would take place on that date and at that time. I'm not going to go on, but can you be more stupid than that? Think of some of the things that could have happened with that type of... I've never heard of that ever going on in a school where they didn't let people know that this was part of what's going on. Well, here's another one. Florida may become the first state, or Florida Governor Rick Scott has signed a law, it is the first state, allowing state employees to be randomly drug tested for drugs, a measure likely to draw a legal challenge on its constitutionality.
But this is the Drug-Free Workplace Act. This will be the only state in the nation that now can randomly test every worker in the state system. Now, are they going to find some people that are probably under the influence or have drugs in their system or something? They probably will, but, you know, we're always trying to balance order and liberty, and there's a cost-effectiveness thing that comes into play, too. You can't run these drug tests, you know, for nothing. So now we're going to be able to test every state employee in the state of Florida to see if they're using drugs. And I think it's clearly in defiance of some constitutional principles, says the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida, and they're going to be out in front and leading the charge to get this this particular law repealed. But it seems like a little overstepping to me. I mean, I'm not talking libertarian or anything else. I'm just saying, does it make sense to test everybody to find one or two? That's kind of like the same logic, take the guns away from everybody to get a couple criminals. And one of those things you'll find out if you happen to get the book Shooting Blanks, they dispel right away this business about you know, these criminals getting their guns like at gun shows. They did a study of over a million criminals, and less than like 0.2, 0.3 or 1% actually ever bought a gun at a gun show. And they can pick these guns up on the street, of course, almost any time. I think we'll just end it there. There's a long story about the Cleveland woman transporting a 15-year-old girl to Richmond for prostitution, and kind of weird about how all that happened, and the woman's been involved in these kind of things before, I guess. But anyway, kind of an odd story. So anyway, we're going to end right there, and we're going to go ahead and shift to hear John Lott talk about his third edition of his book, and it's More Guns, Less Crime, third edition. And when he was scheduled to speak at the University of Texas, the very night, that day, there was an armed person that came on campus. Nobody was hurt. And he was actually, his presentation was canceled, which kind of sounds logical. But anyway, they gave him a venue, not on the college campus, where he could still go and present his findings. And I think you'll find John Lott very interesting. So give me a second here to get this set up, and away we go. This introduction has a little bit to do with what happened on the campus, and I'll play a little bit of it. If it goes too long, I'll just go ahead and move forward. Just listen to John.
Looking back, we realize that all arguments against concealed carry, all the fear of the violence and the surge of violence, it was less law-abiding people carry concealed to those particular ones.
Wish she was under a different. Thanks. I appreciate being invited here. I wish she was under a different circumstance. But it's the basic issue that I was invited to talk about here. And, you know, before I kind of get into the main part of this talk, I just thought I'd mention, you know, for the last 15 years, I've been doing a lot of work on mobile vision public shootings. And I probably have talked to more than 100 people at least who have been at these types of events, actually been present when the attack started. And the one feeling that you will always get through overwhelmingly when you talk to people who have actually been there in that circumstance is kind of the feeling of utter hopelessness that they feel. And it's quite understandable when there's no way for them to go and protect themselves when this rampage is occurring. So some people go and try to throw books or pillows or chairs or whatever that they have that's available to them, but obviously those types of things turn out to be. But obviously those things aren't equal to the harm that can be done from the gun. Their guns make it easier for that to happen, but they also make it easier for people to protect themselves to prevent that. So, kind of before we get into the basic question here about campuses, I thought I would talk generally about the gun-free zones. Because in many ways, this has been a major discussion in the United States over the last few years with two big Supreme Court decisions that have come through, overturning the D.C. handgun ban as well as the Chicago handgun ban. And what my research, not only in the new third edition of War, Guns, and Crime has shown, but in my earlier books, is that I can't find a place in the world where we had a gun ban, and we have crime data both before and after this ban, that we don't see at least some increase in murder rate. In fact, what we find is many times very large increases. But there's not a single case that you can find, I believe you can point to, where there's been a significant drop in murder rate. And you would think, with all the places that have tried gun bans, at least they could point to one example where it's been successful. But, raised against the question I kind of want you to think about generally is, can you name one place where we've had a ban? Because, bans on college campuses is really just a microcosm, one type of example of the type of bans that we have here. As I say, there's lots of experience with gun bans, gun-free zones has been the center part of Supreme Court decisions of recent years. I think in the D.C. and Chicago gun ban cases, Americans generally understand what happened to murder rates after the ban went into effect, that they went up, and they went up fairly dramatically after the ban had occurred. The question is, why did that happen? Despite all positions, guns are bad, and just take guns away is going to reduce it. And it's a basic question that's going to come up when we go more into this example here of gun bans on college campuses, and that is the question of who is most likely to obey these laws. I would argue that when you pass a ban, whether it be on a college campus or you're banning guns in a city or a country, it's basically the good, law-abiding citizens who are the ones who turn in their guns, not the criminals. And to the extent that you disarm law-abiding good citizens and not the criminals, you can have a perverse impact and actually increase the crime rate. And folks, the simplest way to think about this before we get into a lot of the data here, and that is, let's say someone was stalking you or your family, was really stalking your wife, let's say. Would you feel safer putting a sign up in front of your home that said this home is a gun-free zone? Would that make you feel safer to go on and out there? My guess is most people wouldn't feel safer doing that. And the reason why they wouldn't feel safer for doing that is, I think, pretty obvious, because they're essentially telling the criminal, for those person who's stalking your family, that criminal or stalker has less to worry about. They don't have to worry about the people being able to defend themselves. And that rather than actually deterring this person with the weapon from entering the house, what it'll actually do is make it more likely that he'll do it. That these types of signs actually serve as a magnet for causing these types of attacks to occur. And what I would argue is that for places like the UC campus, we actually have these signs almost up in neon, essentially, telling everybody that when it comes to the University of Texas campus or other schools, that to steal handguns as the potential victims, as they say, aren't going to be armed. Now, we'll go through the data for D.C. and Chicago in a second, but there's some who go and argue that these aren't really fair tests. Gun control proponents say, okay, it didn't work exactly right, but that's because we didn't have a gun ban across the entire country. It was possible for criminals to go and get guns from other areas and bring them into the places where the gun ban is true. I would bring 2 points. One is that it would have been nice if they had shared it with everybody else if they didn't think that these were fair to have. But the second point is that these results, these increases in murder and other violent crimes, aren't just limited to Chicago and D.C. Around the world, time after time, in places where the entire nation adopts these bans, or even island nations where they don't have any nearby neighbor that they can go and blame for being a source of guns, also see increases in murder rates and other types of violent crimes. You know, there are many areas of U.S. life where we have these types of gun bans or panthers. But often what I find when I talk to people is they kind of assume that whatever law is currently in place is the way the law has always been. So, for example, after 9/11, I consulted a lot with the airline pilots unions about being able to have pilots carry guns on planes. And often in the discussion, you hear similar types of stories from what's being brought up now, where they say, well, you know, what happens if a pilot accidentally fires a gun? Or what happens if a pilot, you know, goes berserk? Or what happens? Other potential hypothetical things that might occur. Well, my response, after working with pilot unions, there's so many things that you find out that you just never knew were true. So, for example, most of you probably don't know that all commercial airline pilots in the United States from 1924 up until 1963 were mandated to carry a loaded handgun with them when they flew in the United States. They were allowed to carry handguns with them up until 1979, whereas, according to the pilots union, regularly about 10% of pilots still carry their handguns with them. And yet, with all that experience over all those decades, the FAA has not one single record of anything going wrong with all those pilots carrying steel handguns. You would think that there would be at least one story, but there's not. And so when people would bring up hypothetical cases about things that might happen, I thought the best argument would say, well, what did happen when we had this experience? You know, things like whether we should have guns on college campuses. Most people think, well, because we have bans now, wasn't that always the case? And in fact, this is a relatively new phenomenon. These types of rules and restrictions only go back about 16, 17 years or so. Prior to that, there were no restrictions on virtually any college campuses around the country banning people carrying steel handguns or other guns on campus. And in fact, a lot of states have right to carry laws. And people with those permits had no restrictions, whether they were faculty or staff or students, as long as they met the requirements were able to carry the gun on college campuses. And yet, prior to that period of time, despite all that experience and all those things, again, I can't find a single example of something going wrong on one of those campuses. Now, since then, we still have states, Colorado and Utah, have laws on the books that say that on public campuses, people can carry permitted steel handguns. There are many college campuses around the country that are able to do this. Most states leave it up to the schools to decide. But, you know, there are most schools ban it when they have a choice for students. But my guess is nobody has gone through this systematically. Most schools allow faculty or staff to carry steel handguns because, at least in the samples that I've been able to go through with faculty handbooks, you don't see restrictions applying to them that apply to the staff. And again, as we mentioned, this other question. So, what I thought I'd show you is just some data from D.C. and Chicago here. This is murder rate for D.C. relative to other cities in the top 50 cities. Before I go through this for a second, I just want to tell you a couple things. D.C.'s handgun ban went into effect in February 1977 after a restraining order that had been imposed by the courts were removed. D.C.'s murder rates in the year prior to the ban among these top 50 cities ranged from about ranked 20th to 15th. In the 30 years after the ban was imposed, D.C.'s murder rate ranked number one and number two among the 50 largest cities half the time and ranked in the top four two-thirds of the time. So there's a dramatic increase, not only relative to D.C.'s past murder rate, but also relative to other cities. This just compares the ratio of D.C.'s murder rate to the average for the other 48 cities. Chicago's also dropped out just because it also imposes a ban, but including it, because it's just one city has no real impact on these lives. D.C.'s murder rate was falling relative to other cities prior to the ban. Basically, it goes down to about 10% above the other cities in 76. And then afterwards, it soars. I mean, it goes from about 10% above to about 45% above the murder rate in other cities and it basically stays there afterwards. I could go and show you for a period of time after 87, where the reason why I showed you just this is, you know, 40-50% increases here. They look tiny compared to how DC's murder rate soared relative to other cities after the crack cocaine epidemic. This is DC's murder rate relative to Maryland and Virginia. You can see it's rising afterwards. There's no year after the ban where it's lower than it was before the ban. And again, this is continuing out. This is DC's murder rate relative to the U.S., and again, carrying out. Now, one thing that's gotten very little attention is while people may understand how DC's murder rate went up after the ban, there's almost no coverage about how it's fallen after the Supreme Court struck down the ban. About 2 weeks ago, the FBI came out with its new uniform crime report numbers for 2009. And what you can see is that last year, Washington, D.C.'s murder rate fell by 23% compared to 2008. Nationally, murder rates fell by about 7%. If you look at the cities over 500,000 population, which would be kind of D.C.'s class, they fell by about 8%. So D.C.'s murder rate fell by about 3 times faster last year than the national average, going down to a rate of about 23,500 people. That's D.C.'s lowest rate since 1967. And if you go beyond that, you know, you can go and look and see what's happened even this year. The drop has continued. So what I've done in this chart is just compare it for the first 7 months of the year, because I have all the different crime data for the first 7 months, and crime varied over the course of the year, a lot more crimes during the summer and not so much during winter. So you want to compare apples to apples. So this is the first 7 months of 07, 08, 09, and 010. And you can see the first 7 months of 07, 104 murders, 08, 107, and then last year it fell to 82, and then this year it's gone down to 69. There's a 36% drop in 2 years that we've seen in D.C. I can only guess if D.C. has seen a 36% increase in murders and other violent crimes after the handgun ban has been eliminated. That would be major news coverage. But the fact that we've seen this huge drop, well, you know, it's not seen in the rest of the United States, has gotten virtually no news coverage. And you can also compare it to other violent crimes. If you look at robbery with guns, it fell by over 10%, by 11%. Robbery without guns fell by 3%. Aggravated assault with guns fell by 24%. Aggravated assault without guns fell by 8%. So crimes with guns, despite the ban being eliminated, the gun lock rules and stuff, fell by about 3 times faster than crimes without guns. And if you look at Chicago here, Chicago's ban went into effect in November 1982. You can see Chicago's murder rate relative to other top 10 cities was falling prior to the ban. Basically reached a minimum right before the ban was started, and then it rose and basically continued to rise. You can compare it to the other 50 largest cities, again, similar pattern. You can look at it compared to the 5 counties that are adjacent to Chicago, how the murder rate was falling, and then as soon as the ban was imposed, it started to rise relative to the adjacent counties. Not all the counties report crime data for 84, so there's a disparity there, but you can see, obviously, there's a change that occurred there, and you can look at it compared to the United States as a whole. Murder rates were clearly falling in Chicago relative to the United States, right up until the ban was imposed, and then an increase, a very substantial increase, even right away after the ban was imposed. Now, you know, I'm not going to go and argue that any one particular country proves a lot here. There are lots of other factors that one can talk about here, but at least, and I do try to control for the hundreds of factors that I control for my book, More Guns, Less Crime, but even after controlling for them, we still see Chicago and Washington, D.C. showing these increases. I'm just trying to show you very simple comparisons by showing how their murder rate, and I can show you their violent crime rates, rose relative to other similar cities. Well, how about around the world? How about island nations? I'll just show you a few graphs from island nations here after they had their ban. Ireland ban went into effect at the beginning of 72, and you can see prior to the ban, Ireland's murder rate was pretty much bouncing down around here to, between 0.1 and 0.6 per 100,000 people, right up until the ban went into effect, and then it soared up, and obviously a much higher rate after the ban than it was before. You can see a similar pattern for Jamaica. Obviously, somebody can go and point to it and say, we've worked for it as worked for before, and I'm more than happy to say that their difference is very current here. But it really didn't stop the problems that they were having there. And the fact is that even if you can come up with a story in part two of these places, the fact that it's so consistent could be concerned. And here's England and Wales. You can see their handgun ban went into effect in January 1997. Murder rates were fairly, homicides were fairly flat right up until then, and then they gradually started to rise. There's been some reduction in the last year. In 2009, the data just came out, but it's still above what it was before the ban was instituted on the capital rate. So we'll talk a little bit about who made these countries own. So I kind of skipped that, but what Phil Landis at the University of Chicago and I looked at all the multiple victim public shootings from 1977 through 1999. Traditional work on the crime of data sets is kind of some. But there are a couple of interesting things I think we found. One of the things is that law enforcement, while law enforcement is probably the key, the police in particular, are the key factor for controlling crime generally, they seem to have virtually no effect on multiple victim public shootings. No statistically significant effect. And the question is why? And we think we have a pretty simple answer to what's going on there, and that is we look at this, 75% of these guys who committed these multiple victim public shootings died at the crime scene, either by committing suicide or being killed by somebody else who had a gun. And interviews that have been done with at least a lot of the 25% who live, one of the common things that come out is they expected to die. What happened was they just weren't able to go and bring themselves to commit suicide when they actually had to go and do it. They couldn't actually kill themselves. So why is this important for what impact law enforcement has? Because, arrest rates, conviction rates, prison sentence rates, the death penalty, all those affect murder rates generally or other violent crimes. The reason why they don't affect these multiple victim shootings is because law enforcement works by punishing people after the fact. And if people believe with virtual certainty that they're going to die before they engage in these attacks, the fact that you're threatening them with more certain or more severe punishment afterwards really doesn't feel very much to them in terms of convincing them not to do it. Now, one of the things that was also interesting is the human impact Bill and I found from red carry laws on multiple shootings. We looked at 13 different types of gun control laws. We had demographic variables, poverty, income, education, you name it, hundreds of factors that were there. But of the 13 types of gun control laws that we looked at, the only one that seemed to have any statistical impact on multiple victims of shootings was the passage of red carry laws, and it was huge. Basically, after states pass these laws, there's about a 6% drop in the number of multiple victim public shootings, the rate, and there's a 79% drop in the rate when people are killed or injured from these attacks. But if you look at murder generally, there's only about a 1.5% drop in murder rates for each additional year that the laws are in effect. Why is it so much bigger for this particular type of crime? It's pretty simple. It's just a question of deterrence. What I and other researchers find is that as the probability that you're going to be able to stop a criminal increases, you see them commit less crime. And so in this case, let's say I have 5% of the adult population with the skill in that criminal. If you're talking about a place that, in a dark property line where there's one victim and a criminal comes up to them, that represents some risk to the criminal. And you see some deterrence. But, you know, in this room, I suppose, well, we have like 120 people or 100 plus people in this room and the overflow of the back. Even if there was only a couple percent chance that any one individual here had a concealed handgun permit, you know, assuming the probabilities were independent, what would be the probability that at least one person would have a concealed handgun? Probability would be 100%, right? And, in fact, it would probably be over 100% that you had more than two people with permission to concealed handgun. Two people who would be unknown to the attacker about whether or not the people are going to be able to go and defend themselves or not. And so you see this much greater reduction in the rate at which these crimes occur compared to murder generally, simply because the probability that somebody's going to be there to stop these attacks is so much greater. Now, that's my point of saying. What seems to be in the mind, these warped minds, the people who go and do these attacks, is they want to commit suicide. And in committing suicide, they want to do it in some way that's going to go and get attention for themselves. So they like the fact that, you know, people will be talking about them or showing them attention after they die. And you see this over and over again when you read the notes or diaries or other things that these guys leave behind. And that is, they care about the amount of attention. They know how much attention other attacks have gotten in the past. They know that they're more likely to get more attention in the press the more people they kill or injure. And many of these warped minds, their goal is, if they can get more killings than past attacks have done, then they're going to be guaranteed more news coverage and kind of a note in the history book that they otherwise wouldn't have gotten. And so there are issues here about how news coverage and other things affect the way in which these attacks occur. Now, there's some other things we can bring up here. One of the things I think is very interesting is to look at Israel. You know, Israel has had a long history of terrorist attacks, obviously. And look at the policies that they followed in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and very early 1970s. What they tried to do was to put more police or more military on the street with the notion that if they just flooded the area with enough uniformed people with guns, that would stop these attacks from occurring. But the problem that they eventually realized was that was a hopeless goal. And the reason why it was is because terrorists have a huge strategic advantage in engaging these attacks. And that strategic advantage is they have the control over when the attack occurs. And so, let's say you're on a bus, a terrorist is on a bus, and you have two police officers or two soldiers that are on the bus. What are the two options that the terrorist has? The terrorist can either outwait the soldiers. Soldiers could be on there for 6 hours, and then as soon as they leave, the terrorist can go and engage the attack. Or those two people, the terrorist doesn't want to wait, those two people would be the first people that they would kill. Because if they killed those, then they would know that there's other people on the bus who wouldn't be able to go and resist the attack. And so Israel just kept on spending more and more money on trying to kind of flood the area with cops. But they eventually realized that there was no way that they were going to be able to cover all potential vulnerable targets. Because if the terrorists were just patient and waited long enough, they would find some places, some bus, some mall, some place where there weren't police officers there for a few minutes, where they would be able to go and engage in their attack. And so what they did was, in 72, they changed the rules and allowed Israeli citizens to go and carry concealed handguns. Right now, about 15% of the adult Jewish population in Israel is allowed to carry concealed handguns. And whenever there's an increase in terrorist attacks, the national police chief in Israel will go on the media and basically urge those who are able to carry concealed handguns to make sure that they do so all the time when they're traveling around, because they never know when they're going to be able to use. Now, there is an interesting thing that happens, and that is, if you look at terrorist attacks over time in Israel, what you'll find is that all the time up until 72, virtually all the terrorist attacks involved machine guns.
after 1972, versus all the one ball five. There was no technological change that occurred right then in terms of being able to go by. But what happened was is that machine guns appeared to be their preferred method of attack, because they had a choice to use both beforehand. But what changed was is that when you pull out a machine gun, you give the option for those around you to respond to your attack. There was one newspaper story that made a big impact on me about a terrorist attack shortly after the change in the law in 72, where four armed terrorists attacked a mall in Tel Aviv. They pulled out their machine guns and started firing, and people in the crowd around them pulled out their machine guns and started firing back at the terrorists. Three of the terrorists were killed. One was severely injured, and when he was being taken to the hospital in an ambulance, the attendant in the ambulance reported to the newspaper that the terrorist was very upset. He was just uncontrollable. That no one had told him that the old lady to the wall there would be having handguns. he told the ladies, this was just in the afternoon, it was during work hours, they were the ones doing the shopping, were the ones who pulled out their handguns and started firing. Does anybody know where the two worst high school shootings in the world are, were?
Yeah, there was number one in England, wasn't there?
But, well, there was elementary school shooting in Buckingham, but they were in Germany. In the last decade, the two worst public school shootings have been in Germany. One involved 18, another one 17 fatalities. But there are a lot of attacks that occurred in Europe. You've had, I think it was 10 that were killed about a year ago in a school. You go through these, you find multiple victim public shootings in France. You find, even in Switzerland, this last decade, you had one case where 14 people were killed in a parliamentary building at the same time as drugs. But there's one common feature that these places have, that they were all done through zones. What you find is that if you actually look at the rate per capita of multiple victim public shootings in Europe for involving one in four people killed, Europe's per capita rate is very similar to what it is in the United States. Even despite the fact that they have very strict gun laws in places like Germany or France or other places where you have to go through long licensing and psychological screening tests, rules that go well beyond what's been advocated for anybody here in 5 years, at least in the main debate on the issue of gun control. I think part of what goes on, because I get calls from media around the world when there are attacks in the United States, and they often will ask me things like, well, you know, why does the United States have so many few attacks? And when I get calls from countries like Germany or whatever, I'll just remind them of the history of the attacks that they've had in the last decade, and they usually have forgotten about them until they're mentioned. But, we have laws around the country. We have only two states in the United States that still ban people being able to carry concealed handguns, Illinois and Wisconsin. And there's a good chance that at least one possibly both of those states will change their laws after the election. We have 40 states with right to carry laws like Texas does, 8 states which have more restricted main issues. Right to carry laws mean once you meet certain objective criteria, you're certain age, you apply for a permit, you pass a criminal background check, you meet the training requirements if there are in the permit automated branch. The 8 main states may have those rules, but then in addition, they may also require that you get permission for local public officials by demonstrating that you have a certain need to go and carry the permit to steal handguns. Now, just as an aside, Texas actually has a relatively restrictive right to carry law. You have about, as I mentioned before, over 410,000 people right now in the state with concealed carry permits. Compared to something like Pennsylvania has less than half the population that Texas has.
has, but they have, I guess, about 720,000 people right now with concealed carry permits. Why do they have not quite twice as many with half the population? And the reason is very simple. It has to do with the difference in the law. Texas, to get a concealed handgun permit, you're under 65, you've got to pay $140. You have to then go 10 hours of training. You have to go under, go 10 hours of training to renew your permit. In Pennsylvania, it's about a $20 fee to go and get your permit, and there's no training required. But Texas has still a relatively long list, including campuses, where you're not allowed to go and carry a permit to steal a handgun. Pennsylvania has no such list. The only places that are excluded are places which are banned by the federal law. And, it, you know, you see that these rules have a big impact. You charge more, fewer people get permits. But it also changes the mix of people who get permits. My research on concealed carry indicates to me that the people who benefit the most from concealed carry are basically poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas. And when you go and raise the fee, not only do you have fewer people getting permits, but you also see a mix in the type of people who get permits. You basically squeeze out particularly those people who benefit the most from having a permit. And, you know, this is a type of issue that I think is going to come up more with, like, the D.C. and Chicago new gun laws with the huge fees that they have for people being able to go and get permits. And the Washington Post did a study a little while ago which claimed that it took about $500 for them to go through the process to register a handgun. And so that basically means to me it's basically only going to be fairly wealthy individuals who are going to be able to go and get the permits, not the people who benefit the most from having a gun to be able to go and protect themselves. Now, one of the reasons why I think people have the perceptions that they do about concealed carry and kind of concerns about campuses is due to media coverage. Most people get their information about guns from the news media. And when was the last time you listened to the National Evening News broadcast and heard a story about somebody using a gun to protect themselves or protect somebody else? My guess is it's probably pretty hard to recall the story. But probably without trying at all, you can recall what seem to be hundreds or even thousands of stories of bad things that have happened with guns. You know, the FBI had something called the National Crime Victimization Survey, where they surveyed about 150,000 people in a year to try to get information on the number of crimes that occurred. If we could just go and look at gun crimes before the police, in any given year, there are about 200,000 to 250,000 gun crimes reported to police. The problem is, a lot of crimes are never reported to police. So, for example, rape. Only about half of rapes are reported to police. Well, how do we know that only half, or think that only half of rapes are reported to police? We have these large surveys that can go and estimate how many rapes occur and then compare it to how many are reported. Well, we did the same thing with guns. So rather than the reported 200,000 to 250,000, we find that the surveys indicate that there are about 400,000 to 450,000 gun crimes a year. Twice as much as what were reported, the reason to go and do the survey. But those same types of surveys indicate that Americans use guns defensively about 2 million times a year. That means Americans use guns defensively about 4 to 5 times more frequently to stop crime than they use them to commit crime. So my guess is if you're going to go ask most people about that, they think the ratio goes in the opposite direction, maybe even more lopsided in the other direction. And that's because they get their notion of the cost and benefits of guns from listening to the media. If you only hear about bad things that happen and never hear about the benefits, it's not too surprising that they come to those conclusions. Now, one thing I can say is that social media, you know, is a key fact. About 95% of the time that people use guns defensively, they merely have to brandish it for the criminal to break off and attack. Rarely is the criminal killed, fewer than 100,000 times that people use guns defensively. So let's say you're an editor of a news bureau, and you have two stories that come across your desk. One where there's a dead body on the ground to protect a person like a victim. In another case, where let's say a woman brandished a gun, the criminal's run away, no shots are fired, no dead body on the ground, no crime actually committed. You're not even sure what crime might have been committed if it hadn't been stopped. Which story is more newsworthy? I mean, anybody in this room would honestly have to say that the first story is much more newsworthy than the second. We may care about those stories from a policy perspective, but in terms of what the media should cover, it explains, I think, a lot about why they cover the things that they cover there. I don't think that explains all of it, though, because when you talk about these kinds of multiple victim public shootings, there's a secret kind of bias that exists. My guess is, for example, that relatively few people know that over 25% of the multiple victim public school shootings have been shot by citizens well before uniformed police were able to arrive. And the reason why they're unlikely to know that is that when those cases occur, only about 1% of the news stories on those incidents will mention that fact. If you look at what police found in local victim public shootings, about 34% of the news stories will mention how those attacks happened. So, for example, if you look at the first of the public school shootings in October 1997 at Pearl River City High School, if you go and do an exit search, this was really originally supposed to be sponsored by the Federal Society, which would have been all lawyers and most of them. So they would know this, but there's something called Nexus for Westlaw. If you use a Nexus search, what you can find in the 1 month after that attack, you see 687 separate news stories about the incident. Of those 687, basically what happened was the assistant principal there at the school, a former Marine, had a permit to carry a steel handgun. Apparently, regularly, up until the end of 1995, when the Safe School Zone Act was passed, he regularly kept his handgun with him on school property. After the ban was passed, he would park his car more than 1,000 feet off the school property in order to obey the law. And when the attack started that day, he literally had to run a half mile to get his gun and a half mile back. But he still was able to hold the attacker at point-blank range on the ground for over 5.5 minutes before the police arrived. The attacker was in the process of leaving the high school to go across the street to the middle school where he was going to continue his attack. Now, there are 687 separate news stories. 19 of them will mention the assistant principal in any way. 13 of the 19 mentioned that the assistant principal had something to do with stopping the attack. And 10 of the 13 mentioned that he used his gun to stop the attack. Eight of those news stories were still on the
I hope you picked this one up. You can go to YouTube and pick it up. It's a part of the Info Warrior. It'll be John Lott Morgan's Less Crime, and it's 54 minutes in its duration. But John is certainly an authority in this subject and has thought about it probably as much as anybody alive at this particular point in time. So I hope you enjoyed that, and he's certainly a scholar to pay attention to relative to this subject. That's it for tonight. See you next week. Vera Lynn, we'll meet again.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny.